In August 2017, more than 650,000 Rohingya people experienced forced migration from their homes in Myanmar into the neighboring country of Bangladesh. The Rohingya Muslims are an ethnic minority in Myanmar and have their own culture and language, but the Myanmar government refuses to recognize them as a people. They see Rohingya as intrusive, illegal immigrants from Bangladesh. At the time of this forced migration, tensions escalated and resulted in deadly attacks on the Rohingya people. In the first month of the violence, 6,700 Rohingya were killed, at least 750 of which were children under the age of 5. Amnesty International, a non-government organization focused on human rights, reported that Myanmar soldiers also raped and abused Rohingya women and girls. Myanmar is a country that sits between Southeast Asia and Indian subcontinents, over 8,000 miles away from the United States. An international crisis this brutal is difficult to comprehend for Americans that don't have to worry about safety, cleanliness, and basic human rights. Journalist Tanya Rashid, a freelance foreign correspondent, dedicates her life to sharing stories of human struggle and triumph from around the world. Tanya covered the Rohingya crisis in 2017 for PBS and produced several videos on different aspects of the conflict. She made it a point to find voices that are silenced, voices of women and young girls, and share them with her American audience. Talking with Tanya helped me realize that the principles of ethical and sensitive international reporting are applicable in so many situations, whether or not you leave the country. I'm Julie Ciatola, and this is Pressing On, a podcast series that explores the intersection of trauma, journalism, and coping.
I was born in Saudi Arabia by the Red Sea, and growing up in Saudi Arabia was a very isolating experience because I witnessed my mother firsthand not being able to go anywhere without my dad, really. She'd want to go to the supermarket, but then we'd have to wait for my dad to come home from work so that we could actually go. And then I noticed, you know, with my mom, she had to wear the burqa and cover up, and there were the religious police that were monitoring what women are wearing. And so, like, seeing the way she lived as a child, seeing your mother live like a prisoner, it has impact. So that was one part of my childhood. Then my family decided to move back to Bangladesh. And in Bangladesh, it was a totally different story. I had my entire family there. And over there, you know, I noticed, you know, my grandmother had many struggles too. Just she had, I think, 11 children and gave up her life for the kids and lived in a remote village in the middle of nowhere, cooked in a clay oven in a hut. And seeing that and then hearing stories, folklore, Bengali folklore, growing up around that, listening to Bangla music, the culture. There's this atmosphere I grew up in Bangladesh, which was really in tune with nature and the history of my people. And that was another thing that impacted me as a kid. And then we moved to Utah. My mother won an immigration lotto visa. And by chance, we ended up in Utah. And around that time, I think I was about 5 or 6 years old. And it was there that I experienced racism for the first time ever. And I noticed with just being the only brown Muslim girl in Salt Lake City, surrounded by Mormons, that was when I realized I'm different, that I don't fit in. And then again, tying that back to my mother, watching her struggle, having to, you know, because she couldn't speak English and I didn't speak English. And we watched Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers, and that's how we learned. There were no ESL programs. There were no courses like there are these days in different areas. So we really struggled to make it happen. And so, yeah, so in Utah, it was like another struggle, another world. And then after Utah, we moved to LA, and then I grew up in the hood. And that's where I met my Latino friends, and then I saw that there were other brown people like me out there, but a little different. And so that led into this curiosity for the world and the stories that exist in them. And so I decided when I went to UCLA and I got my undergrad, I studied history and global studies. My focus was in South Asian history and African history, post-colonial Africa.
After Tanya graduated from UCLA, she began working at the Grameen Bank, which is a microfinance organization. From there, she worked at Nightline ABC, but she found their storytelling structure too constrained. She decided to take her career in a different direction.
So then I thought, you know, the next best step would be to find an outlet that tells these compelling stories, but in a very natural, engaging way. So I was lucky, and it was during the YouTube era that I discovered Current TV, which is Al Gore's global TV network that eventually tanked. But it was great because it was there I met these top-notch young journalists. It was just a team of really badass journalists. I started as an intern and worked my way up to a production assistant. And through them, I learned powerful storytelling. They did piece investigative stories that won Peabody Awards. And I really, really learned a lot about being a one-woman band and telling authentic stories, but in my own voice. And how language skills and cultural nuance help you dig better for stronger stories.
While Tanya was at Current TV, her mentors and colleagues encouraged her to apply for graduate school. Several recommendation letters later, she found herself at Columbia University in New York City.
And then before I knew it, I was at Columbia and driven as hell. Did two thesis projects. One on Bangladeshi asylum seeker and the corrupt legal processes that go into people seeking asylum in the US with the lawyers and how much they charge. And then I did a second thesis project on my identity, which is many things and something I'm battling all the time. In fact, I would like to write a book about eventually. So it was a documentary on it, which I filmed, shot, edited, and produced on my own. A 25-minute film where I investigate what it's like to be Muslim, woman, an immigrant, Bangladeshi, Pathan, which is part Afghan. All these things, all these layers to my identity, exploring them through the lens of these different characters that represent me in the U.S. So I had a Bangladeshi female gangster rapper. I had a Bangladeshi comedian. I had a lesbian. Because my sexuality is very fluid. It was just all these amazing characters. So after I graduated and I finished that film, I thought the next best step in terms of coming full circle with my identity would be to go to the motherland. So I packed my bags with only $200 in my pocket, and I was in Bangladesh working as what they call a fixer. And I basically helped different international outlets with logistics and travel and booking cars, carrying tripods, all the unsexy, hard, rough work in the field. And then a year into living there, this massive factory collapse happened, which has been considered the largest industrial disaster in human history, where these garment factory workers died in a factory collapse. And these are people making clothes for American brands like Gap and whatnot. And the reporter they had for Al Jazeera at the time was blacklisted by the government. And I happened to be there as this local producer. And I got a phone call from Doha and they said, immediately, you must go there and be on the site and report on this. Before I knew it, I was doing news packages, lives from the field, taking photographs, writing articles. For a solid month, I was a full-blown special correspondent for Al Jazeera English on this factory collapse.
What was that like the aftermath of that collapse?
You're just kind of like in the moment and just maintaining and thinking, I need to get to the story. Yeah. I think what happens is, for me anyway, it hit me later. In the moment, it's adrenaline, it's getting the story, it's making deadline, and that's it. But then afterwards, at night, when you're going to, when I go to sleep, or even like, actually, no, I was still on an adrenaline rush going to sleep, but when you're done with covering something like that, that's when it starts to come back to you. I couldn't eat meat for a very long time because of the stench of the dead bodies in the humidity and the rain. A lot of people were dying underneath the rubble. I saw limbs on the street, blood soaked, you know, the sewer. It was all blood streaming through guts. And yeah, so it haunts you. And then I also, to this day, I can't wear perfume because they would, the firefighters would spray really cheap air refreshener over the dead bodies to hide the smell. But it just had this really, I don't know how to describe it, this rotten smell of meat with this chemical scent. And since then, it's just been, I can't even take car air fresheners or perfume or anything. So, you know, it's like, it strikes your senses and it changes you.
Did you get to take a break after you?
No, I kept going. I started reporting on other things. It's just full throttle. I thought that, because it was like, you, what did they say? You hit the iron rod while it's hot. It was just like, I had my in and I just kept going for it. Yeah. And so for a good few years, it was nonstop. Just covering one thing after another.
Despite the trauma and difficulty of Tanya's early reporting, she's thankful for what the experience taught her.
It forces you to grow up. And I've learned that doing international reporting in hostile environments, I think even if it's not for a long duration of time, you grow at a rapid rate because of all the hindrances that come with it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really tough environment, often with bad internet, and then you're having to write a script while you're sweating and in the middle of nowhere with no food or water sometimes. Working under those pressures, really, they have impact.
When did you come back to the U.S. then?
So it was a back and forth thing.
Okay.
Because my family is based out in California. So I would, and at the time I was married, so I would go back and forth. But I had my home and everything. Home base was South Asia.
Tanya is a self-described permalancer, meaning she has been a freelance journalist her entire career. She says it's hard to find full-time employment in international reporting, especially when you're first establishing yourself.
In the beginning, nobody even cared about who I was. I had my own camera kit and equipment. I went to, you know, whenever some breaking news would happen, I would go on my own to these crazy places by myself, put the camera on the tripod, shoot my stand-ups, send it to them, and then they, to Al Jazeera, this was before the collapse happened, and they would come back to me and send me pity money, like $200, and say, okay, well, it was a nice try. You know, but it was like, that's how hard I was trying to break it. I was determined. But nobody cares. They don't care about you. In the beginning, it's like, who are you? What do you bring to the table? You need work. You need to work more. You need to, you know, it's a very brutal industry.
Once Tanya's freelancing career became more steady, she happened upon bigger stories. This led us to our discussion of the Rohingya refugee crisis and her coverage. Tanya went to the Myanmar region on her own dime in 2017. She had a feeling that the crisis was about to escalate, and her instincts were sharp. Soon after arriving, Tanya, her producer, and their editors back in America knew the conflict in Myanmar was serious. They began their reporting and sent edited video stories to PBS. But before we discussed the logistics of the reporting, Tanya explained the central crisis in her own words.
So they're the Rohingya group. They're a Muslim minority group that's basically been ostracized and hated by the Myanmar Buddhist majority. And they are not considered by many to be human. They're seen as not even citizens of that nation. So for decades, there have been conflict between the Buddhist majority in Myanmar and the Rohingya people. The situation there is really bad. Like, they don't have, I've heard stories about what happens in Rakhine State. The people don't have food. They don't have access to schools or even hospitals. They're just treated like they're completely unwanted. So I think there was this conflict just boiled up over the years, and then that mass exodus happened, which I covered in 2017, and hundreds, not even hundreds, tens of thousands of them fled for their lives because their villages were set on fire, women were being brutally raped, children were being thrown into pits of fire, just things, unimaginable things. Just standing at the border, watching people come, and some disabled with their legs broken, having trekked through the jungle and the mountains for days, seeing people in that level of desperation is unlike anything I'd ever seen before. Not to mention the sky, it was just black with smoke, and I could see visually huts burning in the, as a backdrop. It was like, again, out of another horror movie. I felt like I was in another horror scene.
Tanya and her coworker were staying at a nearby hotel with reporters from large media outlets like the New York Times. They spent long days and nights filming their stories.
Did you find that when you were recording and interviewing that the people were receptive? Like, did people want to talk to you and want to be filmed, or were they... Not so much.
So I think there's an art to doing that kind of thing. You have to really, for me, being a woman, being a Bangladeshi woman, being someone who understands the language and the cultural nuances, there's a way I go about storytelling that's different from, say, a parachute reporter who's just flying in and yelling at his translator to get the right sound bites. The pressure is different for someone like that. For me, it's more about getting to the heart of a story, getting the truth, and also being sensitive to the culture and the women and the people. And yeah, I think having that is an upper hand in my reporting, because I do get very nuanced stories and perspectives that you otherwise wouldn't really hear. Otherwise, it's very, the reports you see are very surface-based, right? For me, it was going into the communities that are not being heard. The Rohingya culture is mostly patriarchal, right? It's all men talking on behalf of the women. So a lot of reports you'll see on mainstream media is with the men. Me, I go into the room and I find the women, and I want to hear from them, because they're not, no one's talking to them. No one's hearing that perspective. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my beat and what I do. It was human to human. And I think a lot of reporters, what they do, what we're taught in journalism school is you disconnect yourself emotionally, and that is your subject, and you're just speaking to them as this outsider and getting the sound bites you need and leaving. For me, it's much deeper than that.
One of Tanya's PBS videos focused specifically on human trafficking, and another on child marriage. I asked her about the ethics and logistics of interviewing young, traumatized children.
So I had been working in the brothels for a while. I don't know if you saw my piece on Vice. I did a story on Dholodia, the largest mega brothel, the largest brothel in all of South Asia. I lived there. I was there for some time. And before that, I used to visit there's another brothel that got demolished in Tangail, Bangladesh. I used to just go and hang out there and observe people. It's just an environment that I've been in, and I understand. Because I'd been in it, I'd been mistaken for being a sex worker. I've gone undercover, pretending to be a sex worker. So when you're in that world and you're embedded in it, there's something to be said about how you connect with people. It's different if you're just walking in and you're just like, hey, I don't know what's going on. I'm gonna talk to this minor. For me, I spent hours and days upon days with sex workers. Most of them are underage, and just talk to them. So I think there is a level of intimacy and communication that I built over time, and like a nuanced understanding about how to approach them and talk to them, because I had lived in it to some degree.
Tanya and fellow journalists must learn to cope after long days of reporting. And it didn't help that during the coverage of the Rohingya crisis, Tanya and her colleagues worked irregular hours, sometimes not eating or sleeping for long periods at a time.
We're just seeing all this fucked up things. And what happens is usually, I'll tell you, so I get done reporting, go home, go to your hotel, take a shower. And then there's a bar inside the hotel. And all human rights workers, aid agency workers, international journalists congregate at the bar, get super wasted and dance. And some people hook up with each other. And in some ways, I think in terms of trauma and coping, I noticed that to be one of the ways people coped. So say we're going into a brothel, that would take hours and hours of waiting at night. Or if we're going into the camps covering a protest, we'd be, have to be up at the crack of dawn. So some days we'd work from 4 to like 1 in the morning. And then I'd have to translate. Well, I probably wouldn't. Some nights I just wouldn't sleep. And then be up again. Very, very odd schedule. And then you don't, I didn't eat all day. You know, sometimes I wouldn't eat, which is not a good idea. We had granola bars, and once you run out of the granola bars, you're just left to boiled eggs that you take from the hotel. But then when I'm in the field with the boiled eggs, they go bad because of the humidity and the heat. And then so there were days you just didn't eat.
So afterwards, after you left and your reporting was done there, did you have any symptoms of like trauma, or did it come back and hit you in a certain way?
I've had trauma since I was a child. I'm a survivor of sexual violence, molestation. I've seen as a child bad things happen to other people within and outside of my family. I kind of told you, right? Growing up, I was exposed to things a little girl probably shouldn't be to some degree exposed to. And I think coming, and then ancestral trauma, if you think about colonialism, the impact it's had on my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and how we survive in the world, it's passed down through DNA. I strongly believe in ancestral karma and trauma. It affects us. It's in our genetics. It's in my DNA. What my grandmother, my great-grandfolks went through, it trickles down to who I am now, and it's part of who I am. So think about that, and then add the trauma I chose to put myself in my reporting. So yeah, I have a lot of things I'm working on.
Do you have like hobbies, things you like to do for fun?
Yeah, so I like to do a lot of yoga. I love yoga. I do lots of yoga. I do HIIT training. I run. I love running. Running is my saving grace. I get that runner's high and it's great. I like to, well, now that I've, with the burnout, I started teaching full-time as a faculty at Stony Brook University. So that's given me more stability in my life. So I have a guy I'm dating and more of a personal life, friendships, valuable friendships, going out to things. I didn't have that before because I was always on the road, packing, unpacking, going here, going there, not a very settled life. Mm-hmm. So having roots has helped.
So what kind of advice would you give to a young or not, just a reporter who's maybe new to international crisis reporting, mm-hmm. maybe somebody who doesn't have the background you did going in, mm-hmm. what kind of advice would you give?
See a therapist, talk to a therapist, have a good support system, have friends that love you and care about you. Don't isolate yourself and be mindful about what you're covering. It's easy to get lost in the rush and the high of being part of a big historical moment or a story, but I strongly believe that everything you do catches up to you, and that could be good or bad, it could be anything. So be mindful of what you're doing and reflective.
Special thanks to Elizabeth Hendrickson, Bob Long, Logan Marshall, and Bernhard Debatin. And thanks to the Ohio University Honors Tutorial College. The theme music for this podcast is courtesy of Joseph McDade. This is the fourth and final episode of the Pressing On series. For more information on the podcast and its making, check out the episode notes and visit our website.